Químico Girona Francia. Y dice, ¿crees una de mí? It is a great honor for me to make introductory remarks for this lecture by Dr. Lo. I appreciate Dr. Lo coming to speak at this general meeting, and I also thank all of the participants of the meeting. Now, I would like to introduce the lecturer first. Dr. Graham Lo, professor of English studies at Waseda University, received a PhD from University of Sussex. He has lived in Japan for about 20 years since he started his career as a foreign lecturer in some universities in Japan. And since 1992, he has worked for Waseda University. Dr. Lo is an active scholar of Victorian novels such as Charles Dickens and Wilkie Collins, and especially the study of serial publication fiction in Europe. He has published some academic books and many articles and reviews. And he has also contributed much for English education in Japan as a writer of textbooks and a presenter of the broadcast. His recent book, titled Serializing Fiction in the Victorian Press, published last year by the Macmillan and the St. Martin Press, is the first comprehensive study of serial publication of fiction in British newspapers. I guess a part of the results of the study will be introduced in today's lecture as the subtitle, Dickens and the Shift from Monthly to Weekly Serialization, suggests. And we will be given a discussion of the frontiers of the topic. Additionally, I heard that he came up with the title of the lecture, Slamming or Slamming, while walking from the station. The Slamming or Slamming is very thrilling. And it is, for me, it is, sounds like a sort of detention style. So I'm very interested in his thrilling lecture. Thank you.
Indeed, for that very, very warm and generous introduction, much more generous than I deserve, I'm afraid. Can you hear me okay if I speak in that way? I'm sorry, I'm going to sit down to read the paper. Just a couple of things first. I speak with some trepidation, in as much as I'm a scholar of any single Victorian writer, I'm really a scholar of Wilkie Collins. I don't claim to be a Dickens specialist. So I speak with some trepidation about Dickens in front of such a room of learned people. And partly because of that, I'm going to focus my talk on the thing, the ground I feel secure upon, which is the ground of serialization. And before I start, can I just point out handouts? This is the handout, the white sheet, which is actually four pages reduced onto one page. There's a bit of everything in there, you'll see. And on the back, there's a picture of little Nell dying. Please don't cry too loudly. Or laugh too loudly if you're an Oscar Wilde fan. But there's tables and quotations from Dickens and quotations from other people and quite a lot of things which I'll refer to. Also, I've put one or two coloured handouts. I apologise for doing that. They're not handouts, they're adverts. Shamelessly advertising the book that's just been introduced and a couple of other things that are related, though slightly less directly, to the topic of serialization. I'm not inciting you to buy them personally, though if you could encourage your libraries, if they have any funds remaining, to buy, particularly this one. I must admit, the one thing I'm rather disappointed about is it has had very good reviews and sold pretty well. But in Japan, very few libraries in Japan have bought it, and it is, I think, quite a useful reference book. So please, if your university has some money left at this stage of the budget year, please encourage them to buy the blue one. Sorry, end of the commercial break. Slimming or Slumming, Dickens and the Shift from Monthly to Weekly Serialization. Slimming or Slumming. The question I want to raise here is whether we should see monthly versus weekly serialization predominantly in aesthetic terms as a relatively unfettered choice between fat and lean installments, to borrow Coolidge's phrase, or rather in mainly sociological terms, as an almost inevitable shift from an elite towards a mass readership for fiction. So aesthetic or sociological terms. This is an issue which, if it arises in an acute form in relation to Dickens's work, is also one which is difficult to avoid in discussing the more general development of the publication of the novel in the Victorian period. An older generation of Dickensian scholars like Coolidge, Grubb, Button Tillotson or Fielding, and they're on the back here on the works cited, the specific works I'm referring to you can find there. This older generation of scholars tended to emphasize the aesthetic dimension. And this emphasis tends to hold true even of those more recent writers like John Sutherland and Robert Patton, who have helped to open up the field of publishing history but retain a particular interest in Dickens. Here, and this is quotation one, John Sutherland on the moment of All the Year Round. He writes, "All the Year Round was in many ways the epitome of the furnace-like conditions in which most of the best Victorian fiction was created. It raised the highest pitch what Thackeray called the life and death struggle with the unwritten number. At the same time, it was, when handled properly, a superb instrument for fiction. No writer in All the Year Round could forget for a moment the mechanics of publication, the pace, narrowness, and need for incessant condensation cut away all fat. The responsiveness of the sails to any slackening tension kept the novelist nervous and alert. Weekly intervals meant that a reader came to every installment primed, which was not the case with monthly serialization, where the plot had that much longer to fade in the memory." In contrast with scholars like Sutherland and Patton, publishing historians without a specific Dickensian slant, and here I'm thinking of people like Graham Pollard and Richard Olteck, they tended rather to push the sociological angle. And in this, it seems to me, they share the preoccupations of Victorian commentators themselves. For example, very important reviewers like Margaret Oliphant or E.S. Dallas, respectively, Dallas for The Times and Oliphant for Blackwood's, as I'm sure you know. Both repeatedly express the fear that a social broadening of readership would lead to literary debasement. And here is quotation two from the sheet. This is Dallas talking about what I call the moment of All the Year Round. That is, it's a review of Great Expectations. An excellent review, which I would recommend. Dallas says, "The method of publishing an important work of fiction in monthly installments was considered a hazardous experiment, which could not fail to set its mark upon the novel as a whole. Mr. Dickens led the way in making the experiment, and his enterprise was crowned with such success that most of the good novels now find their way to the public in the form of a monthly dole." I'm cutting a bit out. "But what are we to say to the new experiment, which is now being tried, of publishing good novels week by week? Hitherto, the weekly issue of fiction has been connected with publication of the lowest class. Small penny and half penny serials that found in the multitude some compensation for the degradation of their readers. Lust was the alpha and murder the omega of these tales." Sounds very attractive to me, to be honest, but obviously not to Mr. Dallas. While the last thing I want to suggest, especially in the present company of the Dickens Fellowship, the last thing I want to suggest is that Dickens is not close to my heart. But nevertheless, I am going to side with the dedicated publishing historians and try to convince you today that the aesthetic concerns should be seen as subordinate to the sociological ones. So, if you like, not slimming, but slamming. Or perhaps better, less slimming, Dan Fleming is the message, at least to begin with. Of course, in Dickens' particular case, it is inappropriate to speak of a simple shift over time from the monthly to the weekly instalment. From the beginning of his career as a serial novelist to the end, from the posthumous papers of Pickwick Club to the mystery of Edwin Drood, Dickens' preferred mode of original composition and publication remains the independent monthly number, composed of two sheets, or around 15,000 words. Yet, at three distinctly separate periods, in the early 1840s, the mid-1850s, and at the turn of the 1860s, he shifts briefly, and I would add rather nervously, to the installment of around 5,000 words within a weekly miscellaneous periodical, before returning once again with confident relief to the monthly number in its familiar duck green wrappers. What is most striking is that, seen as a series, Dickens' three separate reversions to this weekly format reveal an almost compulsive pattern of repetition. And at the bottom of the first sheet, there's, I've just printed out, this is me, rather than quoting from anybody else. A compulsive pattern of repetition. Viewed schematically, the pattern can be represented as follows. First, a sudden decision to drastically alter the scale and form of a narrative which is already at least at the planning stage. B, prompted by an urgent need to protect an investment, this is money, an investment in a new weekly paper threatened by an inadequate level of circulation. C, accompanied by the mechanical issuing of the same narrative in parallel monthly portions. In other words, he writes it in weekly portions, but it's published also in monthly chunks, as an insurance against the alienation of an existing conservative readership. D, leading to a growing frustration with the frequency and brevity of composition required for weekly numbers. And E, resulting in a degree of nervous exhaustion or physical collapse, noticeably more acute than on completing the typical monthly serial. In other words, the same pattern comes up on each of these three occasions when we see Dickens trying out the weekly serial. Given the time limitations today, the most compact way I can find to illustrate this pattern convincingly is by means of a collage of quotations, which may well be familiar to you. They're mainly out of the personal letters and business agreements, and they're culled from either Forster's Life or the Pilgrim edition of the letters. And here I'm simply going to read out this page of quotations to illustrate the way in which this pattern is repeated, but with only small variations. So first, the first time when Dickens tries out the weekly serial is the moment of Master Humphrey's clock in 1840-41, the famous Little Nell episode. And this is Dickens writing to George Cattermole in 1840. Instead of being published in monthly parts at a shilling each only, it will be published in weekly parts at threepence and monthly parts at a shilling, my object being to baffle the imitators and make it as novel as possible. The plan is a new one. I mean the plan of the fiction, and it will comprehend a great variety of tales. And then Forster picks up the story in the second quotation. This is from his first volume, talking about the same moment. He, Dickens, had not written more than two or three chapters of the Little Nell story when the capability of the subject for more extended treatment than he had at first proposed to give it pressed itself upon him, and he resolved to throw everything else aside, devoting himself to the one story only. There were other strong reasons for this. Of the first number of The Clock, nearly 70,000 were sold. But with the discovery that there was no continuous tale, the orders at once diminished, and a change must have been made, even if the material and means for it had not been ready. And then again, this is Forster continuing just a couple of pages later. His difficulties were the quickly recurring times of publication, the confined space in each number that yet had to contribute its individual effect. And Dickens's voice comes in, "I was obliged to cramp most dreadfully what I thought a pretty idea in the last chapter. I hadn't room to turn." And Forster continues, "To this, for a similar effect, his complaints are frequent, and of the vexations named, it was by far the worst. But he steadily bore up against it all." So that's the pattern seen in the first case, Master Humphrey's Clock and the Little Nell story. And then pick up the second instance, the moment of Household Words, writing Hard Times for Household Words in 1854. The first quotation is from the agreement between the partners, the economic partners in Household Words, resolved by the five partners that Mr. Charles Dickens is hereby engaged to write at his earliest convenience a story equal in length to five single monthly numbers of Bleak House to be published in Household Words in continuous weekly portions, with a view to the enlargement of the circulation of Household Words and the consequent enhancement of the value of their several shares. And then Forster quotes Dickens talking about the business of writing Hard Times in weekly parts. "The difficulty of the space is crushing," in capital letters. "Nobody can have an idea of it who has not had experience of patient fiction writing, with some elbow room always and open spaces in perspective. In this form, with any kind of regard to the current number, there is absolutely no such thing." And then again, Dickens's voice in a letter to the Honourable Mrs. Richard Watson, after he's finished Hard Times and he's exhausted, he writes, "Why I found myself so used up after Hard Times, I scarcely know. Perhaps because the compression and close condensation necessary for that disjointed form of publication gave me perpetual trouble. But I really was tired, which is a result so very incomprehensible that I can't forget it." And then the third case of repetition, I hope you can see the pattern that's emerging from these quotations. This is the moment of All the Year Round, 1859-61, where I'm including both A Tale of Two Cities and, of course, Great Expectation within the rhythm. First, this is Dickens to Forster about A Tale of Two Cities in 1859. "I have struck out a rather original and bold idea. That is, at the end of each month, to publish the monthly part in the green cover with the two illustrations at the old shilling. This will give All the Year Round always the interest and precedence of a fresh weekly portion during the month, and will give me my old standing with my old public, and the advantage, very necessary in this story, of having numbers of people who read it in no portion smaller than a monthly part." And again, writing to Forster, this is Dickens' voice writing to Forster about the sacrifice of Great Expectations. So we've jumped on to the second novel written in weekly parts for All the Year Round. "The sacrifice of Great Expectations is really and truly made for myself. The property of All the Year Round is far too valuable in every way to be much endangered. Our fall is not large, but we have a considerable advance in hand of the story we are now publishing, and there is no vitality in it." As perhaps you'll remember, he's talking about Charles Lever's A Day's Ride, A Life's Romance, which was causing these pretty serious drop in sales of the magazine. He says, "Now, if I went into a 20-number serial, I should cut off my power of doing anything serial here, in All the Year Round, for two good years, and that would be a most perilous thing." And the last of the collage, his comments on finishing writing Great Expectation, the same tiredness, the same exhaustion. "I've just finished my book of Great Expectations and am the worst for wear. neuralgic pains in the face have troubled me a good deal, and the work has been pretty close. But I hope that the book is a good book, and I have no doubt of very soon throwing off the little damage it has done me, and that's to MacReady. Now, if you look at that collage of quotations, the main thing is the repetition, but there are minor variations, and I'll just pick up a few of those now. To fit into the weekly serial format, the Old Curiosity Shop expands from little more than a short story, whereas the scope of the narrative that becomes Great Expectations is reduced by almost half. The degree of miscellaneity, how miscellaneous these magazines are, how varied the material in them is, the degree of miscellaneity varies from Master Humphrey's Clock, initially intended to avoid long serials altogether, to All the Year Round, which gives them pride of place from the opening issue. The appearance of a page of the clock is little different from that of a monthly number, whereas the double columns of household words are distinctly cropped. And here you can see this picture here, where you can see Master Humphrey's Clock looks just like the monthly serial numbers, whereas when we get on to household words using the columns, it's looking much more newspaper-like. And I'll come on to the fourth example later on in my story. Moreover, at each of these three succeeding stages, when Dickens returns to the weekly format, the format of the independent monthly number had become increasingly less important as a general mode of publication of serial fiction. Again, at each successive stage, the degree of Dickens' investment grew more significant in both financial and psychological terms. And at each successive stage, the pain of composition in weekly installments seems to have been gradually matched by the pleasure in conquering the difficulties. So there are, when we come to details, there are differences, but in the end, it's the repetition of the pattern which is the most striking thing. And what I want to try to do is to try and make an argument to say why. What lies behind this increasingly urgent compulsion to repeat? And again, the answer, less slimming than slumming, more sociological than aesthetic explanations. Around now, and I shift on now, I'm not talking that much about Dickens now, I'm talking more about the history of serialization. Around a year ago now, following a sabbatical year devoted principally to archival research, I published this book, which as I think is reasonable to say is probably the first time somebody's tried to give a comprehensive account of newspaper serialization. Lots and lots of people have written about magazines. Very few people have talked about newspapers, and that's what this is about. Though that book reaches back to the origins of the practice of newspaper serialization from the early 18th century, the principal focus is on the initial publication of novels in syndicates of provincial newspapers in the second half of the 19th century, describing the reasons for its rise and decline, and discussing the implications for readership, authorship, and fictional form. The research, I believe, casts a distinctly new light on the general development of serial publication in the Victorian period, and results in a revised history, which I outline in the opening chapter of that book. And as briefly as possible now, I want to try and summarize the story of that chapter. And the aim is not just to tell the story, but the aim is to move towards a sociological explanation for Dickens' compulsive returns to the weekly number. It now seems likely that for almost the whole of the Victorian era, a significant majority of original novels, original in inverted commas, original novels published as books, they had previously appeared in installments, either as independent parts, fascicles is the word that was often used, but as independent numbers or within periodicals, whether magazines or newspapers. Particularly in the earlier Victorian decades, however, there was also undoubtedly a vast and still largely uncharted sea of stories which were published as popular serials but never reprinted as books, or at least never made it into the British Library. As Hughes and Lunt argue, and again that's referring to a work on the work cited, Linda Hughes and Michael Lunt, as Linda Hughes and Michael Lunt argue, Victorian culture seems to have been especially receptive to the narrative rhythm of the serial. Its expansive, episodic, cumulative development perhaps reflecting prevailing socioeconomic values. In the first half of the 19th century, as for almost a century before, periodical publication in Britain was distorted greatly by fiscal constraints, tax constraints, on paper consumption, news publication, and advertisements. And these taxes were known collectively by their enemies as the taxes on knowledge. These taxes were designed less to collect revenue, to collect money, than to control dissent. In other words, it wasn't just the money, it was a form of censorship. Controlled dissent by limiting popular access to the print medium. But they did have major and largely unintended side effects on the market for fiction, the market for serial fiction. With the gradual abolition of these taxes, the long-term trend in the 19th century was from expensive, low-circulation monthly formats produced for middle-class readers by book publishers towards cheap, high-circulation weekly formats produced for a mass audience by newspaper proprietors. And that's the key argument, that you get a shift. With the abolition of the taxes on knowledge, you do get a fairly rapid shift from low-circulation, expensive monthly formats to cheap, high circulation weekly formats, and that's the general trend during the Victorian period. And in this process, there emerges the first fully capitalist mode of production in the British fiction industry. In other words, capitalism hits the periodical market much earlier than it hits the book market. In the earlier Victorian decades, the dominant modes of serial transmission of bourgeois fiction, if I can use that phrase, were publication in monthly literary magazines and in independent monthly parts. The new literary monthlies of the 40s were of two types, the 30s and 40s and even earlier. First, the salty Tory review magazines led by Blackwood's, which as early, in fact, as the 1820s, began to include shorter serials. So one type, the salty Tory reviews, Blackwood's. Second, the lighter, frothier, miscellaneous magazines, which tended to be liberal in sentiment and to have shorter, effective lives. And the most successful of this type was, of course, the illustrated Bentley's Miscellany, kicking off in 1837 with Dickens as its first editor and Oliver Twist as its opening serial. By the mid-1840s, original serial fiction by best-selling writers was a firmly established feature of the monthly magazines, which tended to be owned by established book owners, priced at half a crown or more, and with sales under 10,000, even at their peak. By this time, there was also a boom in the publication of new novels in independent monthly parts. This fashion was started, as I'm sure you know, and very, very famously, by Dickens' unanticipated runaway success with Pickwick Papers. And as I've already mentioned, our author Dickens was to prefer this format, the independent monthly number, right up to his death. However, this fact, the fact that such an important writer as Dickens stuck to the independent number, this fact has tended to encourage exaggeration of how important this was as a general publication medium. In reality, new novels in monthly numbers flourished only in the 1840s, when writers like Lever, Ainsworth and Marryat were major competitors of Dickens. Thereafter, the monthly independent part was only a safe option for writers at the absolute peak of their popularity, most notably Thackeray or Trollope in the 60s. And it's important, very important, to note that no novel in monthly parts appears to have surpassed the circulation that Pickwick reached in its last few numbers. That is close to 40,000 per month. And those figures come from Robert Patton's book. So in a sense, the beginning was the peak. So the point is that the independent monthly number was so important for Dickens, but after the 1840s, relatively less important in the fiction market in general. And it's important to recognize that there were exceptions to the norm, that fiction with pretensions to respectability, bourgeois fiction if you like, that fiction was serialized in monthly portions. Some of these exceptions were fairly unique, one-off exceptions. The obvious example is Dickens' weekly experiment with a threepenny clock from Chapman and Hall. Another example, Bentley's issuing of Ainsworth's Jack Sheppard in weekly numbers, also at threepence, concurrently with its monthly appearance in Bentley's magazine. These are exceptions, these are unusual examples. Far more typical of bourgeois weekly serials are to be found in the metropolitan weekly newspapers at this time. Following the 1832 Reform Bill, the taxes on knowledge that I've mentioned were significantly reduced. But at the same time, the new laws increased the value of the security bonds to be posted against the issuing of criminal libel. What does that mean? That the tax dropped, but that newspaper proprietors had to pay large deposits in case of them breaking the libel laws. The result of these two movements, tax down, the bonds going up, the result was that the changes did little to ease the fiscal burdens on the small-scale publisher seeking an audience among the masses. So the main stimulus of the reduction in the taxes was to the metropolitan weekly papers, the London weekly newspapers. So that we can see, after the reductions, there were soon concerted attempts to serialize original fiction in weekly papers experimenting with serialization. Most notably, the well-established Sunday Times, which began in 1822, and as you know, still carries on today. And the other example, perhaps more important, is the Illustrated London News, which began in 1842. And amongst the adverts that I've given you, one of the jobs, very boring jobs, I've been doing over the last 2 years is to index the serial fiction in that paper and one other illustrated paper. Anyway, the Illustrated London News reached a circulation of more than 50,000 before the end of the 1840s, so it was a significant journal. However, both of the weeklies I've mentioned, the Sunday Times and the Illustrated London News, were priced at sixpence. That is still well beyond the reach of the masses. And by the early 1850s, their experiments with serial fiction had stopped. Mainly, I think, because the proprietors wanted to establish a more serious, sober reputation. Why is this? The main reason is that the weekly melodramatic serial by the mid-1840s was becoming increasingly associated with the lower depths of the proletarian market. If the monthly serial was a bourgeois form, the weekly serial was becoming increasingly seen as a low-down proletarian form. Penny Bloods, aimed at the working class, were then written by a distinct set of hack writers like Malcolm Rymer or G.M.W. Reynolds, and they were published by a group of dubious Salisbury Square publishers. It's a square in London, but where the publishers collected, so Salisbury Square publishers were rather dubious, notably Edward Lloyd. And they were distributed not by booksellers, but by street hawkers, or in tobacconist shops. And people often talk about the smell of tobacco that comes with these publications when you buy them because of where they were sold. So from the second half of the 1830s, serial novels in penny weekly parks, in unstamped penny Sunday newspapers, and in penny weekly magazines began to appear in turn. And each of these, the weekly parts, the weekly Sunday papers, the weekly penny miscellanies, each was a miniaturized, plagiarized version of the bourgeois monthly serial. And indeed, in this period, in the 30s and 40s, the word penny, a penny serial, a penny blood, didn't just mean the cost. It implied this process of plagiarism and miniaturization. The Salisbury Square publishers obviously at first learned something from the mass production methods used for bourgeois bestsellers like Pickwick. There, the publishers had been forced to resort to stereotype printing using stereotype plates once sales of Dickens's first novel had exceeded 10,000 per month. But publishers like Lloyd were producing many, many different serials each week, and a run of around 20,000 copies of a penny blood seems to have been the absolute minimum to clear costs. And indeed, GMW Reynolds' Mysteries of London was rumored to approach sales of 500,000. Now that figure, I think, must be exaggerated. Often people pull these figures out of the air. But anyway, if we say a lot, it was a lot. This was probably an exaggeration, but there seems little doubt that by the mid-1850s, the most popular penny magazines were selling well over 250,000 copies, magazines like the London Journal, while the new radical Sunday papers, like the News of the World, were clearing close to 100,000. So these are massive figures compared to the parts of Pickwick papers. But by the mid-1850s, things begin to change. There are clear signs that this big divide between the bourgeois and the proletarian market are beginning to break down. The autonomy of the proletarian market is beginning to break down, and bourgeois prejudice against the weekly serial is also beginning to fade. By the end of that decade, by the end of the 1850s, the typical penny installment novel had shifted noticeably from the penny blood sold in the slums to the penny dreadful, which was aimed at the emerging juvenile readership. So not aimed at the working classes, but aimed at children, particularly boys. Similarly, the penny miscellanies, the penny weekly magazines, were increasingly reorienting themselves in the 1850s towards a women's market, a female market, no longer aimed at the working classes, now aimed more at women. Family Herald is one good example of this. Another sign of the changes in the 1850s, 1860s, is the crossing of borders. Another sign of this crossing of borders is the alarm caused by the fashion for what were soon being called sensation novels, most notably by Mary Braddon and Wilkie Collins. The outrage about sensation novels was due largely, in my opinion, to the fact that sensation fiction transgressed accepted social boundaries. Feminists have argued quite a lot about the sexual transgression, but here I want to emphasize the social transgressions involved. The sensation novel transgressed not only by inserting what had hitherto been seen as the plebeian themes of violence, infidelity, and insanity into bourgeois settings, but also by encouraging the middle classes to participate in the proletarian mode of weekly serialization. During this period then, this is the 1850s, early 1860s, the dominance of the monthly serial undergoes a serious and finally successful challenge from the weekly serial in the form initially of cheap family miscellanies issued in London. However, this development, the growth of the weekly serial in the 60s, has often been obscured in conventional accounts of the Victorian periodical, which tend rather to emphasize the boom, the rather brief boom, in my opinion, in new chilling monthly literary magazines in the 1860s, magazines like Cornhill, Macmillan's, Temple Bar, Belgravia. these shilling monthly journals offered pretty good value to the circulating library subscribers, and they quickly dented the market, both for the older generation of miscellanies like Blackwood's and for the last few novels in monthly parts that were appearing. Macmillan's from 1859 and Smith Elder's Cornhill from 1860 were the earliest and most distinguished, but there was soon competition from lesser publishing houses like Bentley's with Temple Bar in 1860 or from celebrity editors like Mary Braddon with Belgravia from 1866. As with the Cornhill, a few of these monthly magazines started spectacularly with very large circulations, maybe 100,000 or more. But it didn't last for very long, and most of them soon had to be satisfied with an audience below 10,000. For example, Belgravia by the 70s was selling just over 10,000. So, by the early 1870s, the boom in the shilling monthlies was over, and by the 1880s, the menu of fiction offered by the monthlies often seemed second-rate compared with that of the liveliest weekly papers. In other words, by, say, 1880, if you look in the weekly newspapers, you're going to see a better selection of fiction on offer than in the monthly magazines, and that's something that's not often recognized. For well before the period I'm talking about, there was also a wide variety of cheap weeklies which combined installment fiction with other instructive and entertainment matter aimed at a broad family audience, ranging from the solid middle classes down to the servants and skilled artisans of the respectable working class. The origins of these journals were twofold, though they're often difficult to distinguish by the mid-1860s. Some, like the Family Herald, evolved from the proletarian penny miscellanies, while others were influenced by the cheap weekly papers started up in the 1830s by bourgeois philanthropic bodies like the Evangelical Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge, SPCK, or the Utilitarian Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge, SDUK. I'm going to skip out a little bit, but the most famous example of the weeklies before Dickens is obviously Chambers' Journal, which was founded as early as 1832. It was undoubtedly the first and most successful of the weekly miscellanies, and it had a circulation of over 100,000 not long after 1850. Nevertheless, and this is an important point, it's difficult to underestimate the role of Dickens's twopenny plain family journals in making the weekly miscellany acceptable to the solid middle class. In other words, Dickens is very, very important in making these cheap weekly magazines acceptable to a bourgeois audience. That's one of the roles of Household Words and All the Year Round. Obviously, All the Year Round, as we know, reached a much wider audience, partly because it focused much more on serial fiction. Household Words only dealt with serial fiction rarely and didn't give it top billing, whereas All the Year Round, right from the beginning, started off with a serial, and also seems to have been less socially agitative, less political, and that may account for the fact that the sales of All the Year Round obviously were much higher than Household Words. The figures generally given about 40,000 for Household Words and 100,000 for All the Year Round. Certainly, this point I'm making that Dickens had a very important role in persuading the middle classes to buy cheap weekly magazines, this was what the publisher's circular argued. It explicitly linked these developments to the abolition of the taxes on knowledge and saw the appearance of a luminary such as Bulwer Lytton in Dickens' family paper All the Year Round as the sign of a social revolution in print culture. Quotation 3, sorry, it's been a long gap since we've gone to the handout. Quotation 3, I'm just going to quote briefly from the publisher's circular. What it said about the appearance of Bulwer Lytton's strange story in All the Year Round. Perhaps one of the most striking features of the periodical literature of the day is the general leveling of all distinctions grounded upon mere price. The eminent author may now descend from the 6-shilling quarterly even to the penny weekly without the slightest fear of losing caste. In sum, To summarize, by around 1870, the Weekly Miscellanies offered a serious challenge to the monthly magazines, which had already passed their peak of popularity. The success of the Weekly Literary Miscellanies seems to have militated against the reintroduction of serial fiction into London weekly newspapers for a considerable period after the removal of the taxes on knowledge. The continuing campaign against these taxes eventually achieved adequate parliamentary support, and the last of the taxes, the paper duty, was finally removed only in 1861, so they're gradually removed during the 1850s. The immediate results for existing papers were a rapid decrease in price and a surge in both circulation and advertising revenue. These tax changes clearly had long-term effects on the London papers, but the immediate effects of the tax changes were seen much more dramatically, not in London, but in the provinces in the north and the west and in Scotland and in Wales, where there was an explosion of new newspapers. Among the profusion of new provincial organs, perhaps the most prevalent and distinctive, were the weekly news miscellanies. These were priced generally at only a penny. They tended to reach a wide geographical and social readership. These weekly papers gradually began to feature fiction material, first short stories and then gradually longer ones. At first in Scotland, where fewer magazines circulated, and then in northern and western England and Wales. At first, local or reprinted material, but gradually original work by established authors. The Scottish journalist David Pay — nobody else has heard of David Pay in the world apart from me, but I'm trying to sell him as a very important mid-Victorian writer, and there's an advert for the little book I've just done. The Scottish journalist David Pay, who's today almost entirely forgotten, was undoubtedly the most popular newspaper novelist of these mid-Victorian decades. The need for steady sources of supply of fiction encouraged the development of various modes of fiction syndication, initially small-scale, but then gradually bigger, and specialist agencies were needed to provide good quality material nationwide. Though this process of syndication was already a growing force in the 1860s, it didn't reach its full potential for at least another decade. By the later 1870s, however, the dominant mode of instalment fiction, whether measured in terms of the number of works issued, the size of audience reached, or the money offered to authors, had shifted unmistakably from serialization in single metropolitan magazines to syndication in groups of provincial weekly papers with complementary circulations. The firm of Tillotson's, proprietors of the Bolton Weekly Journal up in the northwest above Manchester, were pioneers in this development. Their Fiction Bureau, a newspaper syndication agency founded in 1873, which specialized in serial novels, had a nationwide clientele from the start and an international one within a decade. And right from the beginning, the most popular serial syndicated by Tillotson's, notably from Mary Braddon and Wilkie Collins, the old sensationalists, these could achieve newspaper sales of well over a quarter of a million right from the beginning. And Tillotson's success, and I'll summarize a little bit here, Tillotson's success quickly attracted competition, so that by 1880 there were many, many syndication agencies, and basically all your big name writers were selling the papers to the newspapers. Oliphant, Hardy, Black, Trollope, pretty well everybody got in the act. But by the 1890s, the provincial syndicators really faced competition once again from the London newspapers. By the late 1880s, 1890s, the London newspapers got in on the act and started to carry serial fiction. At this time, people distinguished between class papers and mass papers. Gladstone used this distinction. Class papers meant papers aimed at the distinct professional classes. Mass papers meant papers aimed at the undifferentiated masses. Both types of paper, from at least the 1880s, started to carry serial fiction. Examples of mass papers: Tory Sunday papers like The People, old radical papers like Lloyd's Weekly, most famously George Newnes's Titbits. These were mass papers that carried serials, but also class papers aimed at the middle classes. notably the illustrated papers, the Graphic and the Illustrated London News, the ones that I indexed were very, very important here. So that by the 1890s, the impetus had shifted back to the Metropolitan Press. And also in the 1890s, the collapse of the triple-decker novel also has massive effects on the serial market, so that very, very quickly, serialization itself becomes less important. And the fiction carried in many of the new sixpenny monthly magazines, like the Strand magazine, George Newnes's Strand, owned by a press baron, significantly, not owned by a book publisher. These tend to carry short stories and anecdotes rather than novels. So with the collapse of the triple decker, the serialization itself becomes much less important. There I've tried very quickly to summarize the argument of the first chapter of this book to say that, very clearly, once you look at newspapers, serialization in newspapers, you see very clearly there is this dramatic shift during the Victorian period from monthly to weekly serialization. If you don't look at newspapers, you don't notice it, and people haven't noticed it very much. Okay, if I can just have, can I have five, a few minutes more to tie it back into the Dickens, if that's okay. Sorry, I know I'm talking about publishing history to Dickensians, which is a very dangerous thing to do. While many of the individual events in the narrative I've just given you are no doubt familiar, the storyline I've given is, I think, new. The easiest way to show that what I'm saying is fairly new is to compare my account with of serialization with Robert Patton's lengthy entry on serial literature in Paul Slick's Oxford Reader's Companion to Dickens, which was published only a couple of years ago. I usually like Robert Patton, but I think this is a dreadful article, and I'm going to try and show why. This is quotation 4. After a paragraph aiming to belittle the role and denigrate the character of instalment fixture after Dickens' death, Patton's entry concludes, "Although the novels of Anthony Trollope and Wilkie Collins were sold to republication syndicates for reprinting in newspaper columns as filler, such transactions did not shape or constitute original serial fiction. Dickens' monthly and weekly parts democratized literature, putting new work into the hands and homes of every economic and social class." As the circulation figures I cited today suggest, and as this book argues in much more detail, Patton's argument here is wildly, almost willfully, wrong, wrong, wrong. And his overall account of Dickens' career as a serial novelist, I think, is rather romanticized. Although Dickens' personal career as a serialist cannot be described in terms of a gradual shift from monthly to weekly publication, that formulation seems entirely appropriate, as I hope I've shown, to describe the general progress of serial narrative in the 19th century. Dickens was clearly not only aware of, but in many ways implicated in that development, which continued after his death. And it is the ambiguity of his response to the gradual approach to a mass audience that helps to account for the nervous, tentative, and intermittent nature of his engagement with the weekly format. So, mainly slimming rather than slumming. But I've got one little bit at the end, if we've got a couple of minutes left, called Not Only Slumming, But Also to Slimming, to say that in the end, the sociological side is more important, but there are significant aesthetic implications from which Dickens is not immune and from which he probably bears a little bit of responsibility. Let's go back for a second to the E.S. Dallas Review of Great Expectations in quotation 2 on the handout. Following a number of asides in a patrician vein on modern decline, which echo Thomas Arnold's earlier anxieties about the debilitating intellectual effects of serialization, Dallas finally judges the success of Dickens' new work to be, and I quote, "so great as to warrant the conclusion that the weekly form of publication is not incompatible with a very high order of fiction. At the same time, he recognizes that the mode of weekly publication does indeed set its mark upon the form of the novel. Without using the term sensation, which hadn't yet got into vogue, Dallas notes that the other two early successes in All the Year Round, Collins's The Woman in White and Bulwer Lytton's A Strange Story, are also fast-paced and rely heavily on the mechanics of enigma and suspense. And at the same time, he suggests that the failure of Walter Scott's historical romances when they were reprinted in the penny magazines may have been due as much to the leisurely pace of Scott's narrative as to the debased tastes of his audience. I've cut out a bit here, but basically I've got a table with some statistics to basically show you that you can formulate this in numerical terms. And the basic point is that even when the novel gets shorter as the 19th century develops, the ratio of length between the monthly and the weekly serial remains pretty stable. In addition to this, the business about length, the weekly number also tended inevitably to increase significantly the importance of three elements already apparent to some extent in the monthly serial. These three elements are the striking opening to the work as a whole to increase the chances of its taking with readers, two, the episodic integrity of the individual number, and three, climax and curting endings to installments to encourage readers to come back for more. It was undoubtedly Dickens' protege, Wilkie Collins, three out of four of whose major sensation novels appeared in All the Year Round, who learnt most rapidly and skillfully to exploit these demands. Returning just briefly once again to John Sutherland's commentary, again there's a quotation here. It seems to me that John Sutherland considerably underestimates the generic constraints imposed by the weekly serial when he talks about the furnace-like conditions and the weekly being a superb instrument for fiction only if handled properly. It's easy to assign the failure in All the Year Round of Charles Lever's rambling picaresque A Day's Life, A Life's Romance to advancing age and declining concentration. But there were other and better writers at the height of their powers who were troubled by the pressures of the weekly number. George Eliot, for example, eventually turned down a commission for Dickens' journal because of, I quote, the terseness and closeness of construction of the weekly installment, while in 1863 Elizabeth Gaskell produced for it the novella A Dark Night's Work, her most melodramatic and least characteristic later work. Am I safe to say that? I'm not sure. Anyway. Almost a decade earlier, in writing for Household Words, it should be remembered, even more acutely than her editor Dickens, Gaskell had felt crushed by the limitations of space with her second industrial North and South. It is then not surprising that Dickens didn't ask people like Trollope and Oliphant to write for the weeklies. In fact, Oliphant, in her attack on sensation fiction in Blackwood's in 1862, had deplored the effect on the reader of what she called the violent stimulant of serial publication. This is quotation five. The violent stimulant of serial publication, of weekly publication, with its necessity for frequent and rapid recurrence, piquant situation and startling incident. It is difficult to escape the conclusion that the process of commodification of fictional form, which increases markedly with newspaper syndication and reaches an apogee in fragmentary miscellanies like Titbits at the turn of the century, had its origins in the sensation boom of the 1860s, with Dickens intimately involved through the medium of All the Year Round. So finally, and I'm sure you're glad to hear I'm finishing, finally, both slumming and slimming. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much for your very useful and thought-provoking lecture. In the discussion of the serial publication of fiction, Professor Lu argued that the shift from monthly to weekly had a great influence upon the quality of fiction. And he also explained how Dickens was involved in it through the media, such as All the Year Round and Household Words, and what difficulties and dilemma he has experienced through the shift. I appreciate his showing the topic based upon the close investigation and many examples and illustrations.
very useful for us to understand the power. Thank you. Now, we would like to have the time for questions and answers for about 5 minutes.
Sorry.
Please take this opportunity if you have any questions or opinions about the topic. Could you raise your hand if you have any questions?
Although there was a general sense of the Supreme Authority in the 1850s, the 60s, but still they can try to continue. They must be installed in the Greek house in 54, 50, and little girls in 1855, and also in half of Japan. So that the Greek civilization seems to be the kind of what they say, just for keeping on the new magazine.
Absolutely.
What do you think about that?
Absolutely, I agree that Dickens clearly preferred writing in monthly instalments. As he carried on, he did get certain more pleasure, particularly with Great Expectations, that they're mixed voices, but clearly I think overall he enjoyed writing monthly instalments, he hated writing weekly instalments, he wrote in weekly instalments for money. I mean, that's the general message. But his sponsoring of the weekly magazines did have an enormous impact on the serial market. So that, I mean, Dickens obviously acted. I mean, I'm very keen on looking at Dickens as a journalist, as much as a novelist, and his role as a journalist, as a newspaper proprietor, is the thing that I'm thinking about. But yes, you're right, in aesthetic terms, clearly he got much more pleasure. That was the form he liked. He speaks very, very nostalgically always about the green covers of the numbers, and that came out in one or two of the And I suppose my point is that Dickens is very much in two minds about these things. He's drawn aesthetically to one form, but drawn economically to another form. And in that sense, Dickens is a man of his times. He's very much sort of torn between these two poles. For me as a scholar, I'm very, very interested in this material side of culture. And I think to try and talk about even a major writer like Dickens without seeing the material publishing background, one's liable to make mistakes and misunderstand what he was doing. So that obviously the material level doesn't explain everything. It's not meant to be a reductive approach, but it's a sort of necessary to understand in order to see what the tensions were. But I agree entirely with your point.
Any other questions?
You so denigrate Robert Hutton's article in
Books
for Finance. I suppose you have rather high opinion of his book.
Very high opinion. I think the problem is when he's talking about what he really knows about the earlier period, he's very, very good. But when he starts talking about the later period, I just don't think he really is on top of it. So the problem is the article is about serialization as a practice as a whole. So that when he's on his own home ground, on the end of
the early.
Yeah, I mean, he knows a lot about the independent monthly number. He doesn't know so much about other media, so that when he gets off his home ground, he speaks with the same authority. I know Robert Pank quite well, and I like his work, and really, the book, I really influenced me very, very. He and John Sutherland, another person I'm attacking slightly here, and I've been a great fan of since I was a postgraduate student, but I do feel that article does go off the rails because he talks about things he's not really on top of. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about the index to fiction in the program and news? I just found out, what is your motive or your intention to make
very sorry to say that boring word. Making the index, so to speak.
And have you found any similarity or connection between these two theoreticals?
Yes, they're remarkably similar.
Of course, these are the illustrated.
I mean, the Illustrated London News was already a world-famous, massively popular newspaper when the Graphic began, and the Graphic was almost a carbon copy of the Illustrated London News, so they are remarkably similar journals. But they were both remarkably successful. At the beginning, they were sort of enemies for just a few years, and then they suddenly realized they could cohabit quite successfully, and then they both sort of worked on pushing other competitors aside, and they carved up the market between them so that other competitors really didn't get a look at it. But the more important question, I think, is about the indexing. I mean, I say boring. I mean, obviously, the nitty-gritty of getting the page numbers right is very, very boring. But on the other hand, I believe that the process of looking very closely at Victorian periodicals is a very, very, very important way of understanding the Victorian period. In some ways, we think that the novel is the most characteristic medium of the Victorian period. I think in some ways the periodical is the really characteristic medium of the Victorian period. And, for example, postgraduate students, I think students who want to specialize in 19th century studies should almost be forced to read through periodicals very closely. So I think you do learn an enormous amount by going painstakingly through periodical, so it's not all boredom. And there's lovely distractions. Advertising, the advertising material is wonderful. It's one of the problems, because instead of writing down the page numbers, I keep looking at these adverts for women on bicycles and things. But the reason, basically, today we are desperately in need of indexes to Victorian periodicals. The Wellesley Index, as you know, has done a magnificent job on the quarterlies and the main monthlies, but the weeklies and the popular monthlies still haven't been touched. We have no idea what is in them. There are no indexes, so that for scholars, not only literary scholars, but historians, we need indexes desperately. The only thing I feel ashamed about was, having gone through all these papers, I should have indexed everything in the Graphic and the Illustrated London News, not just the fiction material, but it would have taken me 25 years instead of 2 years to do it. So no, indexes for us as scholars, we need indexes desperately, so I'm not ashamed of having done that very boring job.
Of course, then I realized that how important this sort of work to be. And I have very, very little realized that there are in the Illustrated London News and Graphic any novel or literary work to be worth of attention here.
Now, in the 1880s and 1890s, the Graphic and the Illustrated London News are the, in my opinion, the two key periodicals.
Yes, I'm very much interested in this index to fiction in both periodicals and I will be most sure to buy this book.
I wouldn't try to persuade you to do that. I mean, the only nice thing, obviously, about the topic of illustration, obviously, is now becoming a very, very interesting one in Victorian studies. People wanting to talk about the visual arts and the literary arts at the same time, whether it's in theatre studies or the pictorial arts. So the illustrated newspapers is a great way to do that. And the Illustrated London News and the Graphic, the quality of the illustrations is wonderfully high. They really had the best illustrators of the period working for them. So it is a great visual pleasure to go through those journals. If I can just give one plug for Japan. I mean, I've been in Japan 20 years, and I was in New York a couple of weeks ago giving a paper, and people said, how on earth do you do this type of work in Japan? Because they've got this image in their minds that there aren't any books and there aren't any periodicals in Japan. I'm in Tokyo, and between Waseda and Todai, I think they are two of the most magnificent Victorian studies research libraries anywhere. So you can do very, very, very good research on Victorian periodicals in Japan. The materials are there. Japanese universities have spent some very wise money over the last 30, 40 years, pristine runs of periodicals, useful purchases of microfilms, so that the resources are magnificent in Japan to do that type of work. So if there are any postgraduate students who need a PhD topic to work on, let me encourage you to do Victorian periodicals. Sorry.
Now, we would like to continue the discussion further, but I'm afraid it is about time for us to close. So I hope further discussion will be made in the party after the meeting. I greatly appreciate Professor Lowe's kindness to give us a very useful and stimulating lecture. And I thank all of you for active exchange of opinion. Thank you.